From the deranged mind of a madman with a microphone, it's a drinking podcast with a movie problem. You're listening to Not Suitable for Anyone.
Hey everybody, and welcome back to Not Suitable for Anyone. A bit of an audible this week. I'm calling it audible. I was not expecting to do this, but I had a last-minute cancellation for the second week in a row, which kind of screwed me up a little bit because I just frankly wasn't prepared for, you know, back-to-back cancellations. So I was sort of scrambling to put a show together, and at the last minute, I had someone graciously hit me up and to pull my fat out of the fire, and it's Chris Vanderkay, and he has agreed to jump on the show with me at the last minute and talk about one of his favorite films of all time. So hang tight, and I'm gonna get Chris on the line, and we are going to get right into the show.
Hello.
Hello, Chris.
Yeah, hey. We were going to be talking about Pontypool, right?
Yeah.
The good thing is I've watched Pontypool so many times and love that movie so much that I'm basically always prepared to talk about basically four films, and Pontypool is one of them. So,
well, that's great. I kind of had that feeling. You know, it's funny. Like, it seems to have, you know, a fair amount of respect. But you don't hear people talk about it very often.
No, and especially it's especially sort of insulting that it's so difficult to find. I think right now, literally, you can only get it on Apple TV streaming.
Yeah. I did notice that because I look, because that's one of the things I try to do with my podcast is, like, when I talk about a movie, I try to make sure that people know, you know, where they can find it. That's really frustrating. Like, you can buy or rent it on Apple, but other than that, I guess if you don't have a, you know, a Blu-ray or DVD, you're kind of stuck.
Yeah, and it's crazy too, because, like, people don't know about the pseudo sequel that came out, and they don't know that, you know, Bruce McDonald and Tony Burgess have been trying to make a genuine sequel to it for, I think, like 6-7 years now. They even announced it last year before the whole, you know, the COVID kicked in and everything. So who knows where that project is now?
Yeah. That's wild. And, I actually got sent the screener. And I was just checking Blu-ray.com. I think there's not even a DVD or a Blu-ray that you can buy, which is just, I don't know. The whole thing is just really strange because it's a really good movie.
Yeah. No, this is one of those ones that, you know, if you invited me back on in 6 months to talk about Pontypool again, I would take you up on it. That's how much I like this movie.
Like, how do you describe it to people who haven't seen it before? Because it's one of the more unique things I think I've ever seen.
Well, I mean, that's one of the great and terrible things about the movie, right? Is that the brilliant hook is the thing you can't tell people about to sell them on the movie because you don't want to give away the brilliant hook. And so frequently I will go back and forth and I will say, it's sort of a chamber horror piece meets news radio that takes place in a tiny basement in Canada. And that's kind of like all I'll tell people. And I just, this is one of those ones where I have to say, you're going to have to trust me. This is a situation where, you know, I haven't led you astray before. So go in blind and just watch the movie and trust me. I try not to tell them too much about it because I think one of the joys of this film is sort of discovering in real time what it's actually doing. I've watched this movie, I can't even, countless times now. And so it's a different journey for me every time because I'm looking for all the little details. But that first time, it's really hard to recapture. This movie for the first 25 minutes of it feels like a workplace comedy to a degree, you know? And so I like how it sort of slowly devolves from that and turns into something else entirely. It's one of the great joys of watching it is being, I hate to say, like, shocked, but, like, there is this sort of slow dawning revelation of this thing getting bigger and being weirder than you think. And then the ultimate revelation being like, what the hell? you know, and that's such a great experience that I try to give as little of that away as possible when I'm trying to get somebody to watch it.
Yeah. That's good. And that's a fair point. I think when I first watched it, I think all I knew is that it took place in a radio station. And that might have been it. And because we back when I was still a regular on the Modern Horrors podcast, we reviewed a movie called Feedback that came out, I think in either 2019 or early 2020. That one also has Stephen McCaddy in it.
I literally haven't even heard of that, which is crazy because I love Stephen McCaddy.
Oh, he's fantastic. And yeah, so that one also has Stephen McCaddy in it. And so I guess to Luke, who watching that movie kind of made it like think of Pontypool because it's, you know, Stephen McCaddy in a radio booth again. And he told me it was really good, and that was all I knew. And I was like, okay, I guess I'll just fire it up and
You had sort of the ideal first experience with it then, because I knew a little more than I probably should have going into it. I was listening. I won't even say what the name of the podcast is, because it's a podcast that will sort of give away an element of it. But I listened to a show that was talking about that movie, and it sounded great. But as a result of having listened to that show, I knew an element of the story that had already been given away that I think I really would have enjoyed the revelation of. But I mean, I will say this, even if we end up during the conversation revealing what that is, the great thing about this movie is that there are the big surprises, and then there are also the great sort of little tide pools of weirdness that also pop up throughout this film that are in some ways directly connected to the major theme of the film and the events. But then there's also other fun, interesting stuff that's thematically connected, but also just sort of fascinating and weird. I mean, of course, it's Bruce McDonald. He's he's a very specific kind of director. I think probably most people, if they know him at all, would maybe know him from Hardcore Logo, for which this is a very different kind of movie. But they do both have a sense of idiosyncratic Canadian weirdness to them, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it definitely has that. And I think we will at some point, you know, kind of get into some of the finer details, but yeah, I'd like to see first just how far we can go in sort of talking about this without giving that away. I think at some point, you know, people are going to be curious enough that they'll have to just, you know, shut it off and go and
right.
And watch
and
it.
And that'll be the point back where we can. Yeah. But yeah, I think one of the things I love the most about this movie is that it looks as if it could be at any moment ready to fall into the trap of many lesser kinds of horror films. And I don't mean that in a pejorative sense. I just mean like, you know, films that have lower aims in mind, you know. Mm-hmm. This could have been a movie that somebody made because it was dirt cheap to shoot in a basement radio station, you know. And so it could have been super low budget, but it's actually beautifully shot, like shockingly well made for a movie that definitely cost less than $1 million. It looks much more professional and impressive, and you know, all the credit in the world to the director and the cinematographer who made the movie look great. But there's so much attention to detail in this. The soundscape is amazing. The story, the script by Tony Burgess, he wrote the original novel Pontypool Changes Everything. I guess there's only one part of the book that's really this movie. There's other parts of the book, which maybe that's what the sequel is going to be. But Tony Burgess did a fantastic job, because so much of this movie is about language and the spoken word and the elasticity of it. Every time you watch the movie again, you'll notice that he's doing very clever things with the way that he plays with the way the characters communicate with each other, certain terms that echo throughout the thing. He did a really good job of creating a film that's it's a puzzle box the first time through, and then every other time you start to notice other very delicate clues that have been woven in that are all the more fascinating to find every time you go back and revisit it.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. I mean, it's definitely one, like, for that reason that I want to revisit, you know, sort of over and over again, because there is that sort of layering of themes and layering of context there that, you know, on your first watch, you wouldn't even really even know to watch for.
Right. Yeah. And that's one of the things that I love about it is it operates on two levels. It operates on the level where you're building towards the revelation. And then the second time you watch it, it's operating on the level of, look at all of these intricate elements that were here the whole time and you can only notice them now. But I sort of call it an anti-Sixth Sense in the respect that, and not to insult that film, but when you watch that film the second time, what you're looking for is all of the, I guess you could say, I don't want to say ham-handed because that's not exactly what I mean, but like all of the telegraphed moments that you were like, when you're watching, you're like, oh, see, now that I know that ending, look at this thing and look at that thing. Whereas with this movie, when you watch it again, what you realize is what I'm seeing is not, they weren't really clues. He was trying to tell me something. They were revelations about what's happening to the world. In the bigger sense, in like not just the plot that we're seeing, but like in how the ramifications of the story really do echo out over the entire world. And we're getting this tiny taste of it through these little ripples that we see that are starting to widen. And it's really clever. And it's one of the only films I can think of that is this small a chamber piece that has this big a story. I mean, it's, you know, pretty much, I don't know if it's global, but it's certainly international in its impact, you know?
Right. It is, but it starts in what I understand, you know, from the context to be, you know, sort of a very small town in Ontario, Pontypool, which you sort of, I think, figure out when you try to search for this movie once you first hear about it, is actually like the name of a town in Ontario. And another, like, you know, I don't think it's giving too much away to say that, you know, like another sort of layer to the story is obviously this is a bilingual, this is a bilingual part of the world, you know, where people speak French and English in parts of Canada. And that sort of like linguistic approach sort of has a bigger, you know, role to play throughout the course of the movie as the themes unfold. But at first it's just, you just sort of intuitively take it at face value, I think.
Yeah. I was lucky enough when Kathy and I, my wife, Kathleen and I wrote a book about science fiction film. We spoke to Tony Burgess specifically about Pontypool, particularly the film, not the book so much. But we talked to him a little bit about that idea about, you know, does he see this as a sort of a distinctly Canadian story because of how the film is talking in two languages? And it's actually a very important plot point that there's a certain passage in which they have to communicate in one language and not another. And he said, while yes, that was obviously the inspiration when he first created it, that they've actually done, he said, Pontypool has been made into stage plays in countries all over the world. And he said, normally what he does is he says, you know, not every country has a secondary language that's French, but what he said is most countries do have what sort of like an underground language, like an unofficial second language. You know, here in the States, it's probably Spanish, and then other countries. So basically what he said was have the main language be the official language of the country and have whatever that other language is, French in this, have it be whatever that other unofficial language is in the country. Because he said part of the push and pull of this movie is that in some ways, the whole film is about the struggle to communicate and the lack of communication. So it makes all the sense in the world that you would choose the other language that part of a country uses, but not everybody does. So there's still that boundary, you know?
Right. Right. And the other sort of theme that you see a lot, because which I found actually really fascinating, on my initial watch, is, you know, Stephen McCaddy is sort of the main character. He is the radio personality, and he has this sort of shock jock kind of like Howard Stern type of radio show, but he is also at the same time, like, you can see, like, when they're not, you know, when they're not directly on air, like when he's discussing with his producer, like, what they're going to say, what they're not going to say, and, you know, what they're going to talk about. I mean, he does seem, distinctly concerned about, you know, having verifiable, you know, accurate information to pass along, which, you know, sort of contrasts a little bit with his on-air persona, which has a little bit more feel, like I said, like of a Howard Stern or somebody who you would think would not have any kind of filter and would say whatever, you know, comes to their mind. But really you see that he actually does take it very seriously, and he is very concerned about, you know, what gets said or what gets broadcast and what doesn't.
Yeah, I think, I mean, you know, I don't know, you know, how quickly we date this episode by talking about this, but it's fascinating that we decided to have this conversation about Pontypool, which is about this controversial radio host on the day that Rush Limbaugh just passed away, you know.
Right.
And I think it's interesting because while his character is clearly more a Don Imus or a Howard Stern, the premise of the film is talking a lot about, I feel like, because this would have been 2008, so it would have been before, maybe not before, but like in the very early days of social media. But I think what it's talking about a lot in some ways is talk radio, especially like AM talk radio and the proliferation of opinion conversation over fact-based conversation, you know. And there's, in fact, there's one great passage where he's the person that the BBC contacts to find out what's going on in their little town, and he basically seems to know maybe less than the BBC commentator that's calling in, and yet he's being looked at as the expert in this situation. And I think it just really brilliantly reflects how and I think it's true now too, you know, what is this, 13 years after this movie came out, how woefully unprepared people who consider themselves to be journalists nowadays really are to do the work of journalism, because most of them aren't actually journalists. They call themselves that, but what they really are is opinion peddlers, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, that is a really interesting point. And that is a great, you know, sort of, you know, role reversal there. And I think McHattie's performance in that scene too is really fantastic, because you can really see how uncomfortable he is in that situation.
Yeah. And it has to be said, regardless of what else we talk about, right? Like there are three people that are largely responsible for this movie working. The first is Tony Burgess, and because of the story and how great the story is. The second is Bruce McDonald, who did a fantastic job of shooting it. But I think the largest shoulders for this film really are Stephen McHattie's. Like, this movie does not work if we don't believe and care about and are compelled by Grant Mazzei. And Stephen McHattie is one of those actors. He's that face, right? Everybody has seen Stephen McHattie. Even if they don't know that name, I guarantee you have seen him in something. Especially if it was a film that was shot in Canada. He was 100% in it. But he's been in so many things. He was actually in, I believe he played the original Night Owl in the Watchmen film. He's been in episodes of The X-Files. He was one of the gangsters that was killed in the opening of what was that Cronenberg film? History of Violence. Like, he's just one of those faces that you've seen in 100 things. And this is one of very few times that he's actually played a lead role. He's not primarily known as a leading man. And yet you watch a movie like this and you think, how is it possible that this guy is getting wasted in supporting performances when he has this in him, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, really does. He is so, so talented. And, but he is, you know, he's very much, you know, sort of been known more, at least in the States, as, you know, as a character actor. You know, I think his biggest role, you know, recently, in a, you know, sort of a, even it was in, he was in Come to Daddy.
Oh, and he was fantastic in that too.
And,
yeah. And certainly not to give any short shrift. I mean, I'm a huge fan of character actors. It's just amazing to me when a guy can so easily shift back and forth between, you know, these kinds of brilliant 15-minute supporting performances or, you know, scene stealer in one scene of the movie, but then also effortlessly carry an 85-minute movie, which is primarily a camera in close-up staring at his face while he talks on the radio, you know? That is not a simple challenge for any actor.
Yeah, yeah, no, it really isn't, and it does help. I think that he has a very expressive face. It's one of those that just has a lot of character to it. He's got a lot of wrinkles, and I think, you know, when his facial expressions change and things, I mean, you can just see a lot of character there. And, you know, he's the kind of actor who can say a lot without even speaking a word.
Yeah. Well, and we should say too, he has a voice that exactly matches the face that he has too, you know, like, it sounds like someone poured scotch across sandpaper, you know, like he has just such a great expressive sound to him. Like, it totally makes sense that he got this part, because they said, okay, for 75 of the 85 minutes of this movie, this guy's talking into a microphone. It has to be someone we want to listen to. There has to just be depth and character and interest in that voice too.
Yeah, yeah, and absolutely. And he has a fantastic voice, and he could, I mean, and it's one of the funny things. Like, I could actually believe it if he wanted to have a career in radio. He could do that if that's what he wanted to do for a living.
Yeah, for sure. So do you feel like we've safely passed the point at which we can sort of let the cat out of the bag and talk a little more freely about it? Or do you think there's some other stuff we should cover before we sort of dive into the revelations, as it were, that come from this film?
So I think we're bordering on it. I think the one other influence, I think, maybe that we haven't really mentioned yet, that I think is, it kind of teeters on sort of giving it away. So before we sort of, completely spill the beans, I think there's a lot of, sort of a War of the Worlds type of a feel here, and in part because all we get to see is sort of the inside of this radio station. But I think we've already talked about how there's obviously something bigger going on outside the station than what we can see, and we haven't really said what that is, and that could be any number of things. But I think that's another sort of sort of cultural influence that they're kind of drawing on to bring us this story.
Oh, for sure. And I think one of the fun parallels that draws is when you talk about the War of the Worlds, that broadcast that Orson Welles did in whatever it was in the 30s, I want to say. When they did that broadcast, the power of that was the power of what was fiction, but, quote unquote, fiction, was misinformation and how it guided people into dangerous behaviors, And I think that's a fantastic reflection on where this story ends up going, both, I guess you could say with the actual plot, but then symbolically what the plot is actually talking about in terms of, the real world ramifications of it.
Right, right. And we're sort of living in what they call the post-factual or post-truth era, the era of quote-unquote fake news. This was really ahead of its time, I think, in that respect.
Well, yeah, I mean, at a certain point, we're probably going to have to cop to what we're talking about. But I mean, there's a specific moment in the film, and I just remember watching it. And you know what? Maybe this is a good transition point. There's a point at which people have sort of stormed to the radio station, and they're all mumbling, and it's sort of, they're a huge crowd causing massive destruction to the walls of the facility. They're coming through here. They're all mumbling the same sort of useless, worthless phrase. It's just a phrase that they heard from one person, and they're all sort of just echoing it, right? But without really any meaning, because they're not even saying something. They're just sort of echoing this idea. And I was like, oh my God, that's literally political talk radio. Like, it's a crowd of angry people storming a place, all chanting the same thing, even though they don't really have a very clear idea of what that thing means. They've just become this machine of stupid chaos. And I was like, this movie is disturbingly prescient now,
It really is. I mean, especially now, because I think there was a lot of, so I want to draw this out as much as we can, I think, because I think there's still more to give here, because there was a lot of a lot of the response to the sort of misinformation that has taken hold is sort of the, what harm could it do, right? Like, we know it's not true. So like, if you talk about, talk about like the election, the presidential election, quote unquote, being stolen. Right. And there was a lot of the people were like, there were a lot of people sort of apologists for it, saying, well, what harm could it do? Let him play this out. It's not going to work. Nothing's going to happen. We're still going to get a new president. So there's no harm in sort of appeasing this this lie and this misinformation, and then we saw on January 6th that there actually are real physical, real world consequences for this, for people. People died, people were put in danger, and so it sort of blows that whole theory out of the water that, okay, this is all just entertainment and no one really takes it seriously, and that's not true. And the movie, the movie kind of predicted that, a decade before before any of this actually happened.
No, for sure. I mean, in some ways, the, like what we see in the movie, the these innocuous phrases that become somehow dangerous in the minds of people who, I guess you could say, quote unquote, come to understand them. The whole premise of the movie is kind of like, it's like the audio version of us almost memeing ourselves into chaos. You know what I mean? Like, you know, there's the, there was many people that argue, aside from, you know, other external influence on the you know, election that put Trump in office, that a lot of what swayed people was dumb pictures and memes and crap like that on the internet that uneducated people didn't recognize was stuff that was entirely made up, you know? And so these floating fictions that seem so ridiculous to people who know anything about facts, they're comfortable ignoring them because they seem silly. But that's the thing. The more outlandish the lie, the more likely that people are going to assume it's dumb and you know, not to take it seriously. But therein lies the problem. Nobody's taking it seriously. Nobody's pushing back against it. And therefore, it just propagates, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And people sit back and they think, how could anyone possibly believe this? But when you look at the IRS calls it like the Nigerian like 941 scams or whatever, there's a number that goes along with it. But the whole Nigerian prince scam, right? Where I have $42 million and I need to get that I need to transfer out of this account. So if you will just pay, you know, the $150, you know, transfer, you know, fee or tax or whatever, then I can get this money out of my country and I will send you $1 million. What, it's outrageous, right? And you think, how could anyone ever possibly fall for that? And the emails come in and they are full of you know, misspelled words and bad grammar and improper capitalization. And the point of it all is that it's by design, because what they don't want to make it, they can't make it too sophisticated, because if they make the scam sophisticated, then an intelligent person will start to follow it. And that's the worst thing you can do to a scammer, is make them start to do the work and then withdraw at the last minute. So they don't want anyone smart enough to actually figure out they're being scammed. So they have to make the approach so ridiculous that only the most, you know, sort of susceptible people will fall for it.
Yeah, susceptible and craven at the same time, right? Because they're only doing it because of their bet. Nobody has ever fallen for a Nigerian prince scheme wherein you're just helping someone get their money out of the country and you don't get any. You know what I mean? Right. Like, nobody's doing it for altruistic reasons. They're only doing it because they weren't smart enough to see that it was a scam, and also they thought they were going to make some easy cash off of it. So there's a there's a fascinating dynamic at work there that I think probably says a little something about us as both as humans and also as Americans, which I think is why this movie is fascinating, because this is a Canadian film. But if I didn't know that fact, and if it weren't French as the secondary language, I would say this movie is literally at the beating heart of what's happening in America, in sort of our representationally in our political system, you know? So it just makes me think perhaps that's much more of a universal thing than we think it is, you know?
Yeah. I think it definitely is. I think there's a perception among Americans that when somebody speaks or understands a language other than English, that it either means that they're really stupid or that they're really smart.
Right.
And the truth of the matter is they're just people.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. There's a division too, right? If they speak another language and English, they're smart. If they speak just another language, they're stupid because you don't understand it. So it's a very sort of like Anglo-centric element to it as well, you know?
Right.
But yes, there's so much about this movie that could be dug into, but like it will start to nibble at the edges of what this, you know, revelation in the center of it is. I do want to just point out, I do think it's interesting for people who are readers as well as filmgoers. There is a Pontypool book, Pontypool Changes Everything by Tony Burgess. And Tony Burgess actually is, he's an author who's done a lot of very interesting horror-related books that have ended up being turned into films. He did a book called The Hellmouths of Bewdley, I think it's pronounced. But they turned that into a film called Hellmouth, which also stars Stephen McHattie. And then he's made a couple of other films as a screenwriter. I'm trying to remember off the top of my head. But Ejecta, Septic Man, and then The Hexecutioners, which was one that I actually really enjoyed. A lot of people missed back in 2015. But he's actually a really interesting horror voice, and I think is the kind of person that somebody should definitely look up, because he's not super well known, but if you like one of his films, you will find all of his films really interesting, and you'll find it a worthwhile enough deep dive that you can, you know, find five or six new pretty interesting movies.
Yeah, no, that's fantastic. That's a good tip. He also, I think, did he also write the sequel or spinoff Dreamland that sort of spun off from Pontypool?
Yeah. In fact, it was sort of his and Bruce McDonald's way of revisiting the Pontypool universe, because they've been trying for so long to make a genuine sequel to it. They wanted to call it Typo Chan, which I assume is a reference to the, you know, how the letters were appearing and disappearing in the title at the beginning mm-hmm. of Pontypool, where it just says Typo at first and then becomes Pontypool. So I assume Typo Chan probably means Pontypool changes with all the other letters vanished. But they've been trying to make that since, God, I think 2009, since the film came out, and they haven't been able to do it. So I guess they somehow got hold of enough money to make Dreamland, which is really hard to explain. It's a sequel to the closing credit sequence of Pontypool, which is sort of connected to Pontypool, but is also maybe you can't really talk about it, right, without talking about the movie. But suffice it to say, there's a fascinating, weird sequence at the end of the movie that's kind of a coda to Pontypool, but also shoots off in its own direction. And then they ended up making a movie that was a sequel to that segment, but doesn't really tie into the rest of the movie.
Right. In fact, I hadn't even – it's after the credits, I think. Mm-hmm. In Pontypool, which I didn't, you know, like, it wasn't one of those, you know, Marvel is starting to, like, condition us to sit through all of the credits, but I still, you know, don't always do that, and it was one that I hadn't even, Pontypool was one that I think, you know, the credits roll, and I just sort of turned it off, and I said, oh, okay, it's done, and then I had read that after seeing Dreamland, so I had to pull it up again.
Yeah.
And
fun fact about Pontypool, came out in 2008, the same year that Iron Man came out. So interesting movies with post-credit sequences in them. But yeah, the reason I actually ended up seeing the ending was because I saw the moment up until the credits start. I watched all of that. And then while the credits are rolling, if you listen carefully, there's actually radio broadcasts playing. So you can hear other stuff about what happens in the world, because it doesn't exactly end on a cliffhanger, but it certainly ends at a moment where you're like, I don't feel like I have all the information here. So I was just listening to the radio broadcast thinking, okay, well, maybe I'm going to find out, you know, through this. And then you listen all the way to the end, and then sure enough, that segment pops up, you know?
Right. Okay. Well, so I think we've teased this out long enough. Consider this your spoiler warning.
All right. You ready to dive in the deep end of this, Patrick?
I'm ready.
It's funny because, like, you could just say three words and it would kind of explain it, but then it would also take a half an hour to break down the three words you would use, you know, which is basically like, I don't know, language virus zombies. Is that the best way to sort of summarize it?
I guess that's right. Right. Because it's this phrase. Right.
That's the even more confusing part, right? Because it's certain kinds of phrases. It's not one specific one so much as it is certain ones that have a specific effect on you. Like they even okay. So first of all, we should break down that phrase, right? Language virus zombies. Essentially, what's going on in this movie is there's been all these strange events happening where people are like, I think it right in the very opening, he's driving to work and a woman comes up and puts her hand on the side of the window. And then she's saying something over and over. I think it's maybe the word blood or something. And then she just wanders off into the darkness. That, by the way, is the only external sequence in otherwise a film that takes place entirely in that radio station. And then he gets to work and they start to hear other stories of strange things happening. A group of people that have just stormed a doctor's office and they're all chanting the same word. And then they get calls from some guy who says that a mob has been seen in it, you know, going by this silo. And there's this kid in there that's crying, but the voice that's coming out of him is like this weird voice that keeps chanting the same thing. And eventually the revelation comes to be that there is a virus that is being spread, but it's being spread by language. Like the spoken word is what causes you to catch the virus. You understanding, having a some level of understanding of an infected word is what will infect you. And then you become sort of this, not exactly a zombie because you're not dead, but you like become this sort of like part of the horde, you know, just saying this empty phrase over and over. And I guess the idea is that they go on this rampage because they're just trying to find other people to infect with these words. And so it is a zombie film in the strictest sense in that there's, you know, these mindless people wandering around, but the vehicle is not a bite or some sort of a, you know, transmission the way you would normally find it in a film. It is through understanding of certain words and phrases.
Yeah.
And I think at one point they even say that, like, first, that's what when we talk about the idea of the two languages, right? The revelation there is that they get a broadcast in French and they translate it back into English and find out they're broadcasting in French because it's the English language that's infected, not the French language.
Right.
And so the idea is they're trying to communicate in a language that isn't infected to tell you to stop using the one that is.
Yeah. And that's interesting to me when you said that, like, the, you know, the stage play has been adapted to other countries because it's, you know, I think that, you know, a cultural anthropologist could probably interpret this film in a way to say that it's, you know, sort of an indictment on, you know, on English culture and sort of the viral nature through which sort of Western European and English or British influence in particular sort of spread throughout the world and you know, and eliminated and eliminated or enslaved indigenous cultures and sort of, you know, left its mark all around the world. And you know, and I don't know, that may or may not have been, you know, sort of the intent by making the virus specific to the English language and not other foreign languages, but that's just sort of another interesting aspect of this.
Well, and like you dig even deeper in that, if you know anything about the history of Canada, you know, like the irony here is that English is the language that's infected, French is the one that's okay, and yet the actual indigenous languages of Canada are largely ignored, right? We don't hear anything about the native peoples or what's going on with them because, again, you know, they didn't, they weren't the usurpers, they were the ones that were usurped, right? And so they don't even get a voice in the conversation. I think an interesting corollary to that is there's it's obviously unrelated, but thematically interesting that there was a film called Blood Quantum that just came out recently on Shudder.
It's
a film about a zombie plague, but it's a zombie plague that does not affect people who have, you know, a certain percentage of Native American indigenous heritage to them. And it's a fascinating movie because it's like, it's the reversal of, first of all, what happened to the indigenous people, right? Them getting sick because, you know, a bunch of European people came over with horrible diseases. But also at the same time, it's interesting because it's them being able to take back land that belonged to them through this circumstance that has thankfully not affected them. And I think it's interesting that Pontypool is also came out of the same country. And it's a conversation that probably mostly like white dudes were having. And even though there's some great critiques in this, again, it's a movie that white guys are having and not bringing anybody else into. And so you see a movie like Blood Quantum and go, yeah, good point. That didn't even come up in this movie. That's so much about language and origin and communication, you know?
Right. Yeah. That is a good point. And yeah, that is another good film. And another zombie, film, you know, some, ironically, and yeah, I hadn't even thought about that, but that is fascinating. And part of that is, you know, because, I mean, there is that certain element, you know, that history is written by the victors,
mm-hmm.
right? Like we call George Washington and Thomas Jefferson patriots. But if history had gone another way, they would be traitors, right? And Benedict Arnold would probably have like his own national holiday.
Right. Well, I mean, we don't look at Star Wars. We don't look at the story of the rebellion as a terrorist group. You know what I mean? But they did attack and blow up the Death Star. You know what I mean? So like, it is certainly a matter of perspective in some cases.
Yeah. Absolutely. That is an interesting point, and so I don't know if writer here was making a sort of a broader statement in that respect specific to, you know, the English language or you know sort of Western culture influence on the world, or if that just happened to be, you know, these are the tools that we're working with, which is probably more, you know, what I suspect was the case. But it's an interesting angle to consider nonetheless.
Yeah. Well, I do certainly think it has to be intentional on some level because of some of the other things that happen in the film. You know what I mean? Like, it would be impossible for me to think that you weren't commenting on sort of the, I don't know what you would call it, the anglicizing of everything. If you made a movie that had a sequence where you created an English language version of the telling of Lawrence of Arabia, where the natives are singing a song in English about being on the, you know, about being Bedouins and stuff. You know what I mean? Like, they literally have that sequence and it's all white people in brown face. So I kind of refuse to believe that that wasn't in some way intentional, because these guys are pretty smart. The two filmmakers are pretty smart. And while, yes, they are, I mean, at least I know in the case of Bruce McDonald, you know, straight white guys, it seems it's too many coincidences for this to all be coincidence. You know what I mean? One coincidence is believable. Five of them mean there maybe was something behind it.
Right, right. Yeah, and I think there's a it reminded me too of there's a line, it's almost kind of a throwaway line in Men in Black, when Tommy Lee Jones is showing Will Smith around the office, and he's kind of showing them like all the different like inventions that they have gotten mm-hmm. from alien cultures, and he shows them the universal translator, and he says, well, we're not even supposed to have this, because human thought is so primitive that it's thought of as an infectious disease on some planets.
Yeah, no, it's, and one of the other things I think is kind of fun about this film is it is in some ways like old white guy. I know Bruce McDonald's probably not that old, but like old white guys sort of taking the piss about themselves, about a problem. You know what I mean? Something that very rarely happens in films, I think, sometimes, where you get a group that recognizes a problem about the group they are a part of, and instead of pushing it off on someone else or apologizing for it, they sort of lay it bare. And I think one of the things I like the most about this movie is the way in which satirically our main character, Grant Mazzy, does kind of stand in as the problematic white dude to some degree. You know, he may not be terrible, but like in all ways, but there are a lot of ways in which he is terrible. You know, the idea that he considers himself a newsman, and yet when he gets bored, he decides to make up fake crap in order to, you know, keep himself interested during the segments where Pontypool isn't producing enough, you know, genuinely interesting news, you know? And so it's literally showing us that sort of that slippery slope between, you know, journalism and commerce and the idea of, you know, where does the ethics of entertainment versus reporting the news come in? And I just felt like the movie was very interesting in that it felt like it was directing some criticism back towards entertainment in some ways. You know, I thought it was very interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. That's fascinating too, that you bring that up. Because, you know, and I used a word, earlier, and I think it was, you know, it was largely sort of an innocuous word up until, you know, until this week, I think. And that's content, right? we've sort of been increasingly referring to, you know, to films and TV as content. And part of that is sort of this, because we're in this era where those things are sort of conflating with one another. I mean, it used to be very bifurcated, right? I mean, TV was a specific thing and it had commercial breaks. It was advertising supported. It was only shown at certain times. It was even shot and broadcast at a different aspect ratio from mm-hmm. films. And now you have, like, you know, things like Netflix making what they call TV shows. And I'm like, well, that's not really a TV show because it's not broadcast. I can just watch it whenever I want. And I think so I think people just sort of lumped it all in this one category and they just called it content. OK, it's just this generic term that refers to everything. It's movies. It's, you know, shows, serialized programming, whatever you want to call it. It's all just content. And Martin Scorsese, you know, has released another essay, which was making the rounds this week, where, you know, he's offended at the idea that you would refer to, you know, what he creates as content. It's just, you know, it's art. And it's like, you know, and I guess I don't think he didn't use these words specifically, but, you know, it's sort of like, would you call the Mona Lisa content? You know, or would you think that Da Vinci would find that insulting? And we have some similar themes at work here.
Yeah, no, it's true, and I think there's a ton. First of all, a ton of things that could go into that too. Like even if it wasn't just the word content, which I do think it was a poor choice of words, but also at the same time, like you said, the world has kind of transpired the world has conspired to bring about. Over the last year, there is no such thing as a movie because there's no such thing as a theater, right? Like, so we're living in a world where we don't have any choice but to watch everything in the same, in the same venue, and therefore it does start to blur, like, what is what? And I to a degree, I can understand the confusion, but at the same time, I also think, like, it's not even just content. It's like, well, you know, would you call artists creatives? Like how far are we going to move into the commodification terminology of something that's supposed to be considered an art form? You know what I mean? Like, I don't think anybody would say Van Gogh was one of a really interesting creative, like they would probably call him an artist. Now, whether we want to say that film falls into the same category as, fine art, I mean, I obviously think it does or can. But like, yeah, I think it's a fascinating conversation to have. And I certainly think that one of the things that's great about this film is it does one of the things that's my favorite about the horror genre overall. And I have like an elaborate theory for why a horror film has the potential to be the greatest piece of single art ever created. But the reason I love the horror genre is because it's allowed to talk about all these things while simultaneously still being an entertaining piece of pop cultural work. Like, how many movies are we still talking about from the 50s through to now that were horror films? There are a lot of films that were, I guess you could say, socially relevant. And let me tell you, nobody's watching the quote unquote social films from the 50s anymore. You know what I mean? There are scads of filmmakers that were making movies about, the evils of bigamy or whatever it was they were talking about socially. The great thing about horror films is they've always been talking about social issues. And because we're entertained by the story on the surface of it, we're willing to continue revisiting them and looking at those social issues that are underneath, because the story itself is both symbolically about that, but also its own unique animal, as opposed to a social message film, which is only about the social message. And therefore, you're not also getting the really entertaining horror narrative that we get,
Yeah, I never even really thought about it that way, but you're right.
Like Ida Lupino is, I love her as an actress and a director. She was one of the first woman directors, and I think at a certain time the only woman director that was a member of the guild, and she made films in the 50s. She directed like 6 or 7 films. Most of those films can either only be found by, occasionally they pop up on the Criterion Collection, or you got to buy very expensive versions of DVDs, except for one. Which one? The Hitchhiker. Why? Because it's a suspense thriller, like a borderline horror film, and not a social story, even though it technically is still a social story. All of her other ones that are about, polio and, stage parents, a parent forcing her child to be a tennis player even when she doesn't want to. Like, all of those are social stories. Those don't have shelf life, even though they're great movies. People aren't watching them anymore because society has changed and the way we talk about it has changed. But we still watch The Hitchhiker because at the base of it, a crazy hitchhiker with one eyeball that won't close even when he falls asleep, that has, two people kidnapped at gunpoint in a car. Like, that's a compelling narrative that you'll revisit, even if it's 45 years old,
Yeah, absolutely. That's what I think is so compelling about the horror genre. You can just enjoy it on that level, right? You can watch a film like that and never go any deeper than, than the surface level story. And that's fine. And, and you can certainly, find a lot to get out of that. But there's also, again, just sort of layered context there that you could read into it. And what's fascinating to me is, sometimes it's intended. Sometimes it's projected by your audience, where your audience says, I've had this experience in my own life, and it may be something that the filmmaker, may not have experienced themselves. But if you see that, if you see yourself, people like to see themselves, on the screen, that makes perfect sense. And then sometimes it's just there, sort of subconsciously. As a filmmaker, you don't even realize, but it's just because you are so entrenched in your own perspective, and your perspective is sort of skewed by your experiences to the point that that's all you can see. And it takes somebody who approaches it from a different perspective to say, well, you know, here's you know, how I see, you know, imperialistic themes or whatever it might be, you know, playing out in this story.
Right. Well, I mean, I call that, like you said, there's one where it's intentional, there's one where it's sort of projected, and then I feel like absorbed is probably that final category, which is it's steeped in the time and place that it was made to the degree that you'll only notice that when you're out of that time and place. You know, we can look back now, even though it's not that long ago, we can look at the Saw franchise and go, it's not a shock at all that that was a franchise of movies that was coming out in the wake of what we found out about Abu Ghraib or what we found out about Guantanamo Bay, right? Where there's huge conversations happening in the American conversation about is torture the right thing to do? Is it an evil that leads to a better good, right? Of course, that would be playing out on the screens in Saw, you know? Not that they were going to answer the question, but because that's a conversation that's so obviously being had in the hearts and minds of, you know, Americans at the time, of course it was going to spill over into our entertainment, but of course usually only in horror where you're allowed to be transgressive. Those kinds of conversations aren't largely happening in, you know, domestic dramas and stuff. So I think it's interesting that we weren't necessarily looking at that when the first Saw film was coming out, but here we are a decade, you know, whatever it is, almost a, you know, 15 years later, or however long it's been, we can look back and go, oh, of course, that was us like sort of existentially working some stuff out, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. It makes sense when you say, because just at surface level, like there's no reason why a story like that should connect so viscerally and resonate so well with culture that it became, you know, the number one horror movie of the year for, you know, several years in a row.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, you know, the only thing that toppled it was the, you know, Paranormal Activity came along and it was the new obsession, because I feel like it was embracing a new kind of media that people were interested in, you know, the found footage phenomenon. So yeah, it's interesting. Like we can see a pattern, but we can't necessarily explain a pattern because we're part of that pattern at that time. It takes us, whether it's someone from another country noticing culturally that that's us about us, or whether it's from someone from another time saying that's something about that era, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. It's like the Nazca lines in Peru, right? If you're standing on the ground, you can't see the shapes. You can't see what those animals are. It's only by, you know, flying overhead, you say, okay, that's a monkey. That's, you know, whatever it might be. You need that detached, you know, your distance from it to understand, you know, the full picture.
Yeah. And I think like, Pontypool came out in 2008, and I think it was a conversation about one thing at the time. I do feel largely it was a phenomenon of, God, it'd been happening since the mid-90s, I think, right? Like the rise in AM radio and the shock jock or the political commentator. That was a thing. It feels like this movie is largely sort of talking about. But it is definitely now, it feels just as much about the proliferation of false reporting and fake news. I mean, this movie is literally like fake news, the film. You know what I mean? Like this, it could literally just be called that, you know? If there wasn't already a film called The Social Network, this would probably fit the bill pretty well. It perfectly drops in that way that a good symbol can stand for different things depending on what generation is looking at it. In the same way that the ring in Lord of the Rings means multiple things because it doesn't mean a single specific symbolic thing, you know? So it meant in Pontypool in 2008, it did mean talk radio. And maybe a decade ago, it meant, I don't know, this is a bad example, but maybe it meant MySpace. But like now we're in the place where social media as an entity, it makes sense as that, you know? We have apps. I mean, I'm on one. I use it all the time. We're on Twitter, where they've limited the number of letters that you can use to say a phrase. So you are automatically locked into having to only say this little or less, you know? We have created our own environment that we can blame for the belittling and the stupidity that humanity has become. And yet we're the ones that did it to ourselves, you know? So it's an interesting film that I think will continue to resonate as more things like this pop up and humanity continues to make these stupid stumbling efforts to improve ourselves that end up actually making ourselves worse, you know?
Right. Right. Yeah. I always picture, you know, sort of some anthropologist, you know, 500 or 1,000 years from now, you know, just explaining to their students this rare form of poetry that is expressed entirely in 140 characters or less.
Yeah. No, it's for sure. It's almost like saying it's like poetry, except we don't have any boundaries except for the length, you know?
Yeah.
So there's no meter, there's no rhyme, and there's no reason, as it turns out.
It's like haikus to me. That was like the one thing I always sort of compared Twitter to when it comes to, you know, some sort of like art form is haiku. It makes no sense why you would put these arbitrary limits. Like, they just seem completely arbitrary to me. Yeah. And I don't know, maybe and for all we know, there was some very good actual technological reason why they structured poetry in that very specific way.
Mm-hmm.
We just don't know what it is.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny. And I think the more we talk about Twitter, the more I'm like, oh my God, Pontypool is Twitter the film. Because I think about, like, you know, all the characters we were talking about earlier. Remember the army of people that break into the place and they're all chanting that same phrase that they all heard from the first person that was infected. And they're all saying it now. And all I can think of is like, oh, that's retweeting. And that's quote tweeting, right? Like,
we're
just echoing the thing that somebody else said and sort of like bandwagoning on. And it's like, oh my God, this movie really was predicting things. Not that social media didn't exist in 2008, but it really has made an enormous impact in less than a decade, more than we think it has, to the idea that if we did go back to 2008, it wouldn't be shocking that Tony Burgess and Bruce McDonald basically didn't have much in the way of interaction on social media, and therefore that's not the conversation they were having, you know? But that conversation they were having perfectly applies to it.
Yeah, it's fascinating because we're at a point still where a very small minority of people are actually on social media, but social media affects your life whether you know about it or not, or whether you're on it or not, because the regular media, you know, pays attention to it. My wife doesn't really do much social media. She's on Facebook to get information about what's happening around the community and stuff, you know, when there's activities to do and things like that. But, you know, she doesn't consume it where she like is constantly like talking about what our kids are doing or what she's doing or anything like that. She goes on, she reads it, she sees what's happening around the neighborhood, and that's what she uses it for. And but I'm steeped in it. I'm on Twitter and I'm on Facebook, you know, sort of throughout the day, and just, you know, having conversations and just sort of understanding what people are talking about. And it never fails when something, and you can almost see it coming now, where something really starts to take hold, you know, the sort of meme culture where this is really taking off and like everyone is glomming to this. A day and a half later, my wife will just turn to me and say, and she's looking at something on people.com or CNN or something, and say, hey, did you hear about this? And I'm like, yeah, that happened. That information is like 36 hours old now, you know?
Right. And the idea that it's so hilarious that we think it's old when 36 hours is, that's not that long, you know, right. But when you operate in the Twitter sphere, the, you know, Facebook world, everything moves at such a pace that's A, why disinformation can and misinformation can spread so fast, but also that's why it burns out so quickly, right? Because we're constantly looking for the next thing, you know? And honestly, I think that's another thing that happens. It's reflected in Pontypool. Like, you remember there was the moment at which two of the people go into the booth to hide from the one person in the workplace that it's clear has become infected, right? And mm-hmm. So she starts repeating the phrase, they recognize what's going on. They go into the soundproof booth and they close the door. What happens to her at that point? She's repeating the phrase. It's almost like it's an echo device. She's trying to find a person because she needs to say a thing to a person and have it bounce off of them. And when it doesn't happen, she literally explodes from within. And I feel like there's maybe no better analogy for the way in which social media fucks with our brains so bad than having a thought that you need other people to hear you say. And if you can't get it to them, something bad will happen to you. You know, like I've done this to myself, you know, like I had a tweet that went viral one time and it was crazy. And at the time I was like, oh, this is terrible. Guess what? Been chasing, trying to get a viral tweet again, just because there was something fascinating about watching something that you did connect with and, you know, and move through the world of other people through this medium. And so, like, you watch that moment in the film, and yes, it's sort of like a gross, horrific exaggeration of it, but it's not that much of an exaggeration. It's just been physicalized. Like, social media, they've already established that social media does kind of rewire your brain in the way that you interact with information and how you want to share it. So, like, it's not all that crazy to think about that. I have thought of something and been like, oh, I got to tweet that. Not like I just thought of something. I thought of it and then thought I have to do something with it, or it's not valid, you know?
Every time your phone buzzes, or, you know, or you hear that little ding, or whatever it is, and, you know, and the dopamine gets released from your brain going, someone's thinking about me. Someone approved of what I said. Someone saw what I did. Somebody, you know, spreading my message. You know, that releases chemicals in your brain.
Right.
And
we've seen it can be weaponized too, right? Like, I mean, of the reasons that social media has been delinquent in its responsibilities is because it's creating an environment where dangerous people with dangerous ideas are given massive platforms, and they absolutely know how to utilize what you're just talking about, right? If you can cultivate someone's hatreds, and you can, I don't think you can make a person who is not racist racist, but I do believe if it's a person who is inclined to be the natural level of racist that all white people living in America tend to be because they benefit from white supremacy, you can absolutely weaponize that and sharpen it and turn it into something that becomes active and intentional as opposed to something that someone's doing accidental. And the way you do it is by feeding that need, you know, and social media allows for the creation of that. It's another way that it connects back to this film, right? Like this dangerous thing that's spreading because it spreads in small digestible bites that don't seem that harmful. In fact, I believe, didn't they say when they translated that French phrase of like of the words you're supposed to avoid, one of the things you were supposed to avoid was terms of endearment.
Right.
Right? Right. And why would that be? Because terms of endearment connect emotionally to you. It's not just intellectual understanding. It's about having some sort of an emotional response to this thing. And that's how it gets inside, I think, in some ways. That's how you're quote unquote infected in this movie. And in social media, I think it's kind of the same way, right? Like people are utilizing these technologies to connect emotionally in an artificial way, utilizing an artificial way of stimulating emotional connection with people and then utilizing that to, you know, weaponize whatever it is they want you to believe or do, you know?
Whether it was designed to manipulate that or not, it definitely benefits from it and takes advantage of it.
And for sure, like, even if they didn't invent it for that reason, they hired people after they found out it was working in order to figure out how to make it work better. You know what I mean? There are for sure people who do nothing but work on algorithms to make sure that they're putting the thing in front of you that keeps you in front of that thing, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And chemically, it's no different than someone with a drug addiction or a gambling addiction or something like that. As far as your brain chemistry is concerned, it's the same process. It's sort of this validation loop that your brain says, oh, this is good. I like this. We need more of this.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the same thing that, like I said, that gets people addicted on drugs or what have you, or whether it's, you know, whether it's a risky lifestyle, you know, any number of things.
I have to say, I've talked about this movie a number of times on a number of shows and in the conversations with people, and this might be my favorite conversation about it, mostly because we've used this as a doorway into the much more dark and complicated things that this movie is actually about. Like, I never would have imagined that we would have ended up where we ended up talking about this movie. But then again, also, the last time I talked to someone about this movie in an interview was before 2020. You know what I mean? So, like, the world has kind of changed, and this movie has become, not that social media wasn't around before that, but this last year in particular has really shown a light on what this movie is talking about. And sort of in some ways, it's not talking about the technology, it's talking about the problematic human intent that makes the technology so dangerous, you know?
Right, right. Yeah, it's you know, it's funny. Earlier today I watched Psycho Gorman. Which is a fairly recent. I don't know if you've seen that one yet.
Not yet, but it looks great.
It's fantastic. But there's a great line where one of the kids is asking if, you know, if monsters are real or something. And sort of the upshot of the conversation with the parents is that you know, the monsters, like, as we see them on TV and movies, are not real. But the reality is that people are the monsters. You know, we are the monsters. And that's really true. And I've often said that, you know, when people blame, they want to blame Facebook or they want to blame Twitter for these things. And it's like, the technology is just a tool. It's the people using the tool that are the problem. And,
right. Well, and also the lack of regulation on the tool when you know that it's a dangerous tool, you know?
Right. Right. Yeah. And so in that way, you know, Facebook, you know, social media is essentially completely unregulated in, and not to say that there aren't regulations on guns, but I think there's a valid discussion to be had about whether, you know, whether we need more regulation. And
well, we definitely need at least as much regulation on social media as we do on guns, I think.
Right. That's kind of the point that I was trying to get to exactly is, you know, it can be just as dangerous. And, you know, and there are probably still today people who would shake their heads and say, no, you know, that's not, you know, you're exaggerating. But I direct you to January 6th.
Yep.
You know, I direct you to, you know, the dead police officers. You know, yeah. It's
well, and also you can guide by negative example too. You can see what a success certain kinds of deplatforming have been. You know, when Alex Jones was no longer allowed on Twitter and other places like that, he didn't disappear. He wasn't a human being that suddenly vanished off the planet, and it's not like he's not problematic. But guess what? The bullhorn that he had is no longer quite as loud as it was. You know,
right.
He's not able to profit as egregiously as he was off of the things that he was doing, and so. You know, whether you want to argue that there are corporations that are way too friggin' big and have the power to make or break someone's, you know, popularity or political career or whatever, is a different conversation than whether or not those companies should have some level of responsibility to not let people do that kind of stuff. You know what I mean? Like, that's where I think the conversation is worth having. And that's where I think this movie's kind of interestingly sort of talking about that, too. I think one of the most hilarious things that happens in this movie is that at the end of the film, we see how truly unequipped Grant Mazzy is to stop what's happening because, you know, this isn't really a spoiler because it doesn't exactly tell you what happened. But like the way that his character ends in the film is there's a countdown happening where they're going to bomb this city to wipe out whatever the virus is off the map. And his way of trying to defeat it is literally just screaming gibberish off onto the airwaves. You know what I mean?
Right.
And when I think about that, I watch that sequence and I think, oh, my God. Did you see the speech that Alex Jones gave before people stormed the Capitol? I mean, like, it's not all that different when you think about, like, all this bluster with no actual content or thought behind it. Like, that's what it reflects to me. And that sort of terrifies me at the same time that it's hilarious only in the sense that, like, you don't have to look at the ramifications of it. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But it's terrifying when you look at, you know, in I guess you'd say when you look at it in context with what it leads to.
Yeah.
And who the hell knew we were going to get to a point like this talking about an awesome Canadian zombie movie?
Getting back to sort of like movie narrative that I really like is, and I like movies where the characters have to try to solve a problem,
mm-hmm.
You know, where they're given some problem to overcome and they have to sort of intellectually figure out how to overcome it, you know, where it's not just brute strength or something, you know, things like, you know, movies like The Martian. Or something where, you know, someone just has a series of problems and they just, okay, I'm going to solve this problem and then, you know, that's going to lead me to the next thing and then I'll solve that problem. And eventually if I make enough correct decisions, I can reach my goal. I can get home or whatever I'm trying to do. And so he's trying to figure out, you know, how to sort of reverse the effects of this language virus that, you know, he has this idea, I guess, that if words are, you know, causing this infection, then maybe there's some other word that can, you know, can reverse it.
Right. The idea being, I think at one point he basically convinces someone that a word means a thing it doesn't mean. And that's what sort of snaps them out of it, you know? And there's a brilliant passage in this film that I think maybe describes the American situation currently better than anything else, which is there's two Canadian people sitting in a room talking to each other in broken French because neither of them speaks French very well, trying to create a plan that will help them defeat the infected English language, but they're really bad at speaking French and therefore their planning is not going very well. And that just makes me think, Like, that's literally what we are. Like, when we're talking about trying to figure out how to fix social media, none of us know how it works. None of us know what the algorithm is. You know what I mean? Right. So the idea that any of us would dare to try and figure out how we could improve it, because we don't even understand it. We're all talking to each other in broken French about an infected language we don't know how to stop.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's absolutely the case. Because between French and English, I mean, we're talking about algorithms, right? And languages that are spoken by machines, mm-hmm. Not people. Machines don't, at least to the best of our knowledge, they don't have agendas, they don't have goals, they just see a problem.
They told you, Patrick? Of course they would tell you that.
So, yeah.
But no, you're right. I mean, like, it's that whole situation. I mean, it's literally like, go back to the Terminator franchise. You know what I mean? We created something that I thought was going to be helpful to us. It got to the point where it was doing the job we gave it so well that it destroyed us because we were the problem, it's like... Social media is not alive, but if it were, it's Skynet as a, so we're not going to be defeated by Skynet turning on bombs and exploding. We're going to be defeated by, milkshake duck. You know what I mean? Like, we're going to be defeated by such stupid things at the end of all of this.
Yeah.
Or, we're all going to die sick in the streets because we refuse to believe science because it didn't look as pretty as this graphic that someone sent me.
Yeah. Well, and that was the thing. So I was listening to a podcast over the weekend, and they were talking about the impeachment trial and, sort of the aftermath. And there was a person on who was like a Democratic Party strategist. And they were sort of explaining the things that I think we largely already know, the media talking about Trump is how we got Trump as president in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And instead of just focusing on issues and things, it was just anything he did. Like, and Covfefe was a great example of that, where it was just something that was completely meaningless. And I'm sure was just the equivalent of a butt dial or a hand slip, and something got tweeted out that was just nonsense because we all fat finger things from time to time. And instead of ignoring it and discussing actual issues and problems and things, Twitter just blew up for 5 days. Over what does Covfefe mean, and all this, and now we're making the same mistakes again with people like Marjorie Taylor Greene, where we're just amplifying the dumb things that are said instead of just ignoring the things that don't matter and focusing on issues.
Yeah. What it reminds me of is the sequence brings us back to Pontypool, where they knew they had to sort of distract the horde that was outside the radio booth. So he recorded himself saying the phrase "Sidney Brier is alive," like and then he put it on the loudspeaker and it was playing throughout the building. And then all of the people in the building started repeating it because that's what they do. They glom onto something and they just start saying it. And then as the crowd wanders off and goes someplace else, that message goes with them. And it made me think, oh my God, this movie has perfectly shown us the way that dog whistle politics work, right?
Mm-hmm.
You say a phrase and there's something hidden inside of it, and other people are going to parrot it and not know what it means, but they'll think that they're saying something good. Like when you say family values, right? People with families think, oh, that must be good. I'm going to talk about family values, not realizing that what that's actually couching is, hatred of the LGBTQ community. You know what I mean? Like there's this way where we've hidden a message so that it spreads out through the crowd, and the people that we want to know what it actually means, they'll get it. But everybody else is sort of in the dark about it. Just like this crowd of wandering. Actually, I think it's kind of funny. Bruce McDonald said they're not zombies. In fact, he called them conversationalists is what he called them. But they wander off. This buzzword on their mouths that they don't even know what it means, but they're just saying it over and over into the ether,
Yeah.
Yeah, fascinating.
Absolutely.
I also, not to steer away from what is, you know, a really fun polemic about our country, but there is one moment in the film that I think is not only hilarious and horrifying at the same time, but it's also just like symbolically saying so much, I think, about, I don't know, just society in general and the things we put our trust in and whether or not we can actually trust them. And we've got Grant, right? Grant Massey's the host of the show, and we've got the two producers. I was at Laurel Ann, I think, is the assistant, and the producer Sydney, and then they've got the traffic reporter, right? Ken Loney, mm-hmm. in the helicopter in the sky. And so this is our team, and they're giving us the news, and we trust this news because we trust the people that are quote unquote telling us the truth. And then the ultimate reveal of the movie about Ken Loney, after he has died, we learn some things about Ken Loney. The first one is there is no helicopter. He is sitting on, he's sitting in his car on the top of a hill looking down on the town. And that is how he gets his traffic reports done. Right. There's no helicopter. People just feel better thinking that he's up in the sky. And then the adding insult to injury, after he has died and Grant is talking to Sydney about him and how sad it is that he died, I think it's the point at which Sydney says, he wasn't great. He was a child molester. And then he goes, you see his face register like, what? And she says, you know, I don't know that there's any proof of it, but I would never leave my kids around him. And I'm like, oh my God, this is insane. Like everything about this man has just shattered in real time. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's just, it reminds me so much of the constant American trauma experience of looking at our leaders, you know, mm-hmm. that we assume that they're professionals who know what they're doing. And then that's shattered in two ways. The first is we find out that they don't know what they're doing. They don't understand their job. And then it's shattered in the second way when it turns out that they're creeps or grifters or perverts or whatever. You know what I mean? Like, so not only are they not experts, they're not even decent people. And I just, that moment in the movie, just like you see Grant's face and you go, you know what? I understand that face. I understand that feeling. It has all come crashing down.
Yeah. Yep. Absolutely. I mean, I think the easiest way to become disenchanted is just to become an expert in any subject and then listen to your leaders talk about that subject.
Oh, this is why I'm glad I'm just a jack of all trades.
And or even like, you know, even like the national news. All right. And and you hear all the things that they, you know, that they clearly don't understand or that they get wrong. And, you know, and then you start to think about, well, gosh, if they're wrong about this one subject that I just happen to know, then are they wrong about everything that they're telling me?
Yeah, exactly. Well, listen, I don't know how long we're going to run, but I have to ask you because it's the most fascinating part of the conversation for me, at least, to have.
Yeah.
Which is the ending of the movie. There's so many interpretations of what that piece means. You know, the part that comes after the post-credit sequence, I guess you call it. If I had to describe it, what I would basically say is that the two characters that we just saw, the only two that were of our characters that are left alive, they're inside of the radio station as the countdown is happening before a bomb is going to get dropped on this town. And Grant is trying desperately to stop it. He's, you know, yelling to the people that are listening to the radio station what they need to do to get better. Then we get to the end of the countdown. It goes to black. Then we go to credits. When the credits are over, it fades in. Those two characters are sitting in what looks to me, at least, to be some sort of a restaurant. He looks like he's dressed like a Tarantino gangster. I think she's in some sort of like a Japanese kimono dress or something. Mm-hmm. And they're talking to each other in this sort of weird vernacular. It's sort of like, it almost sounds like jazz speak in some ways, but not in any phrases that you've ever really heard. And it basically sounds like they're on the lam from something. And then it basically ends with the two of them kissing and it cuts to black. It cuts to black at the end.
Yeah.
I spent a very long time trying to figure out what I thought this ending meant. And so I'm curious, where did you come from as far as what the hell did you think was going on when you first saw that?
My answer to that, I think, is going to be colored by the fact that I had already seen Dreamland before I went back and watched this. This ending sequence. So there's context, you know, there when you watch, you know, when you sort of watch those two things play out together. The most obvious answer, I guess, is, you know, that either that this is some kind of a purgatory state, you know, somewhere between, you know, between reality and afterlife, that they sort of find themselves in, or it's, you know, it's something like, you know, like the Matrix, where they've been woken up from, you know, from some reality that we've been living in to sort of, you know, resume some other life, or the converse, I guess. It's really bizarre, and it seems, I don't even know what I would think just watching that from the context of just seeing Pontypool itself. It's one of those things that I can't even necessarily separate.
Okay. Yeah, I was curious because, you know, the first thing I thought of was it starts in black and white. And the only other part of the movie that was also black and white is when he's listing the obituaries of the people that, you know, succumb to this. We see shots of those people and they're all in black and white. So that was my assumption, was we're technically sort of seeing their obituary sequence. But I heard an interesting theory I thought was pretty fascinating, which is the idea that all the changes that we've seen are changes that have come about because the world needed to adjust to the new reality, the new normal of there being the virus, right? So the strange language is them communicating the way they have to now by altering the language so that they're not using the words they used to use before, you know? And I started thinking about that, and it became ultimately horrifying to me when I started thinking about this, because this has been my theory for a few years. But then as of, you know, 2020 happening and the way the world literally had to readjust itself around the existence of this virulent, you know, disease that's traveling around us. And I started thinking like, oh my God, that ending takes on much darker connotations than you think it might, if that's what it means. Because now what we're saying is these people have to communicate in a way where they are trying to get their point across, but not so clearly that people really understand them, because they could be putting each other in danger and possibly getting them killed by having conversations with them. And I started thinking like the extrapolation of that into the real world now, you know what I mean? Where going out of the house without a mask on, even if you forget and it wasn't intentional, you know, you're putting yourself and other people at risk. And I just started thinking, like, if that's what this ending means, again, horrifyingly prescient, this film.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. And I guess it hadn't occurred to me that, you know, that maybe it's, you know, these are different characters. I'm kind of sort of taking the chain of events literally, that, you know, that it cuts to black and, you know, the bomb has gone off and, you know, and you get this very, you know, sort of strange, you know, sort of dreamlike sequence that fades in. But, that's really fascinating. And that does make, you know, sort of an interesting sort of segue into Dreamland. Which I don't want to go all the way through Dreamland, but it has that same kind of Dreamland has that same kind of feel to it, where you know, it's a reality, but it's like a hyper reality, where you know, the words that people are saying a lot of times, you know, they don't make sense. It's not how people talk to each other. And it's also kind of like this Matrix Reloaded type of vibe to it, where, okay, yeah, there's vampires and, you know, sort of mythical creatures here that are just accepted as, you know, part of the society. And that's just a thing that exists that everyone just sort of goes with. You know, Stephen McHattie is playing two different characters.
And no one points out that fact.
And no one says, "Hey, you look a lot like that other guy."
Yeah, no, it's fascinating. And I almost feel like, while I love that, I love Dreamland not as much as Pontypool. Pontypool's one of my favorite films. But while I love Dreamland, it kind of does, I don't know, I wouldn't say it lessens the impact of that final sequence in Pontypool, but it does, like you said, it feels more like the primer for a sequel, because you saw the sequel and then saw that ending. And so it looks like it sort of feeds into that. And I wonder, because my understanding is what Bruce McDonald said was that sequence was not originally supposed to be at the end credits. It was supposed to be the genuine end of the film before it went to credits. So it was supposed to be like right there attached to the movie, as if that was the way that the film ended. And they moved it because the producers were confused and frankly concerned. but that is what Tony Burgess and Bruce McDonald intended the end to be. And so it feels, where it is now and the sequel that came, you know, the spinoff film that came from it, does make it feel like it's a separate entity, as opposed to being connected to Pontypool in the way that it feels like, at least to me, that McDonald and Burgess intended it. But since I don't understand necessarily, I don't fully understand what their intent was, I guess I can't get mad about it feeling different, because who the hell knows what they actually meant for it to do, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that does, I mean, that does change the tone of the film somewhat, because, I mean, it is, the Pontypool does, you know, I mean, it is kind of a, you know, kind of a dour ending, but like you said, and, you know, with that interpretation, you know, it's almost, I guess it's sort of, you can look at it two ways, right? On the one hand, we sort of figured out how to adapt and move forward, on the other hand, our reality now looks nothing like what we thought, you know, what it was before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I've said this about many movies, but this Echo, like, I'm not obviously putting this in the same tier as David Lynch's work. Well, I do for me personally. I wouldn't necessarily feel other people would necessarily think that. But one of the things I think is that the power of Pontypool and the end of all things is that what it effectively does is make you try to... Well, it effectively sort of makes you not understand things you thought you understood, which is kind of the premise of the characters in the story, right? Like, they need to stop understanding a language in order to be infected by it. But it also just, it does a really good job of making you feel like you don't understand the thing you just watched, and then maybe you don't understand some other things too. So that, I feel like there's a value to the ambiguity and open-endedness of this movie in a similar fashion to, like, you know, anybody who watched Twin Peaks: The Return, that... that comfort with confounding people that Bruce McDonald and David Lynch both have, where they're not interested necessarily in having a secret mystery that they're then going to reveal to you, and then you have all the answers. That's not really what they're in the business for, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And Lynch is even sort of like famously good-natured about it. You know, there's a great sequence with him on Family Guy. You know, he actually voices himself in a scene where, you know, like there's a kid that just looks at him and says, "I don't understand." And David Lynch just says, "That's the whole point." And I don't think that really is, I don't think he's just trying to confuse people for the sake of it, but he understands that that's how a lot of people look at his work. And, you know, and he can kind of have this detached humor about it.
Yeah, well, there's that fantastic meme when he was doing an interview, and I don't remember which movie it was, but somebody was reading a quote from him where he said, you know, "In some ways, I think," I don't know what it was, maybe he said, "Eraserhead is my most spiritual film." And the guy says, "Elaborate on that." And then it just, David Lynch just goes, "No." And that's it. That's his answer. No. And something about that is actually endearing, because I feel like, and I may have talked about this when I talk about Pontypool in other places, but we didn't talk about it, which is like the tyranny of narrative in some ways is like choking us nowadays. The idea that if a thing happens in a movie and you don't have a full explanation as to exactly why and what the character's motivations were, people think it's bad writing, right? They think there's a plot hole, you know? Like, if you leave a Marvel movie and somebody did something and by the end you haven't been told why that character did that thing and what secret he was hiding that made him do it, then people say, "Oh, that's a sloppily written film." Whereas I think one of the great things about art is being able to wander out of something that you've just watched or seen or whatever, and the question remains what something meant and why something was the way that it was. Because if you're not having that conversation and trying to figure that out both yourself and in tandem with conversations with other people, then the art didn't so much challenge you as it did pause, you know, your life and then placate you with an answer, you know? And something about Pontypool that just really endears me is that sort of pioneering sense of wanting to say, we're going to keep walking forward, even though we don't necessarily know everything that's in front of us, and we didn't understand everything that was behind us, you know?
Yeah. Dreamland definitely felt felt that way to me. You know, it felt very Lynchian in that respect, where I sat and watched that entire movie, and I can't really explain more than about 50% of what I saw.
Yeah. Well, I definitely think that the parts of Pontypool that I would consider Lynchian are just the straight-faced acceptance of things that are clearly not possible as if they are scientifically real. I mean, there's literally a sequence where three people are talking to each other about how a virus is traveling through the spoken word, which is absurd. not traveling through germs like that come out of a person's mouth, because it can be transmitted over the radio. Like, you can be infected by just hearing a thing. That's patently absurd. And yet the movie fully embraces that and like leans into that in very fun ways, but always keeps a straight face about it. And I think that's maybe one of the things that makes people think that this movie isn't as absurd as it truly is once you sort of dig deep on what it's getting at, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. And that's a good point. And part of that, I think, you know, I mean, to me, part of that is just good filmmaking, you know, that we're not going to stop and bog the story down with the skeptic and right. This thing There's... that we're clearly seeing happening isn't actually happening. There must be a, you know, quote, there must be a rational explanation for this.
Right.
We're just going to skip right past it and go to the acceptance phase.
You know for sure that they could have done that, because Grant literally makes perfect sense as the Scully character, right? As the skeptic. So the fact that he's one of the first people to not only accept it, but then theorize what the hell they're going to do about it, means we're in new territory here. We're not in the, you know, the believer skeptic dynamic. We're in this heightened pseudo reality where things on their surface look right, but just underneath it, we're saying very outlandish, ridiculous stuff, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. You know, I don't know what it is about Canada specifically, but you seem to see more so than you know, than American cinema, these sort of outlandish kind of realities that are, you know, that are just sort of accepted as part of the narrative, so that they can you know, sort of get on with the story. I mean, right. Lynch is probably the most famous example of this, but you know, but there's so many you know, Canadian films that play out like this.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. I mean, it kind of taps into another thing I'm fascinated with, which is the idea of magical realism. You know, the idea that everything in the world is regular and mundane, except for this one outlandish thing that's sort of stuck right in the center of it, and everybody is behaving as if that's normal. You know, that's a part of the. I mean, in this case, they're not behaving as if it's normal, but they accept it as if it's perfectly, you know, reasonable as much as anything else in the universe is. You know, and so there is that element of sort of magic realism in this. You know, that one surreal thing in an otherwise sort of mundane and ordinary world.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. That's a lot of fun. So Chris, why don't you talk about, I know you're an author, you've got a podcast. You know, I don't know what order you want to talk about things in, but, yeah, why don't you just sort of tell people, you know, what you do?
Yeah. So, well, I mean, I guess I'm a lot of things. I'm a little bit of screenwriter, filmmaker as well, although not as much lately, working on some projects, but, you know, I never want to jinx them by mentioning them before they've been given the green light. My wife and I are actually authors. We've written several nonfiction books about the history and philosophy of horror and science fiction films. We wrote a book called The Anatomy of Fear, which is interviews with horror and science fiction filmmakers. We wrote a book called Horror Films by Subgenre, which basically breaks down horror into 75 distinct subgenres. Obviously, that's not all of them, but we did 75 of them, and we sort of talk about what the earmarks are of them, you know, like what are the psychological pressure points of each one, some exemplary examples of each, you know, kind of thing. We did another book called Indie Science Fiction Cinema Today, which is just about independent sci-fi movies from the new millennium. And then we did a really fun book called Spoiler Alert, which is a coffee table book just talking about, it's basically, I sort of describe it as like a template book if you wanted to write the world's most cliched version of this kind of movie, you know? So it's got like a romantic comedy, and it's got a three-act breakdown and the your standard stock character. Then it's, you know, it's basically a satirical book about, you know, well-known Hollywood genres. And then I've also written, since we're talking about zombies here, I should probably mention Kathy and I wrote a book called Life After Death, which is a fiction book. It's sort of a post-apocalypse story, but it's, our take on the zombie story is it's far more interesting if you start the story after they've already solved the zombie plague and then everybody has to sort of get back to life. You know, what's life like once you found the cure, but everybody has to go back to work as if they didn't have to stab someone in the heart with a chair yesterday, you know? So, you know, if the whole world was basically one open wound and everybody had PTSD, what would it be like to have to get back to normal?
Oh, that's interesting. Have you seen that movie, The Cured, that came out, I think, in like 2018?
I did not. Well, no, I don't think I did. Doesn't sound familiar.
It's, I want to say it stars Elliot Page.
I haven't seen it.
Wrong about that. Yeah, it's an Irish film. Yeah, and it basically is, so it's all about, so it was like 2017, 2018. So it basically, it's like you were talking about, it starts sort of after the cure. They've discovered a cure to the zombie plague, so people who were zombies are now, have been cured, and, are now essentially people again. But I think they still, like, carry some characteristics or trademarks from being zombies, like in the eyes or something like that. And it's really kind of used as sort of this allegory for institutional racism and things like that. It's really fascinating. Definitely worth checking out.
Yeah, that sounds interesting. I mean, definitely a different tack than ours, which is really more sort of a thinly disguised recovery manual for getting past the Trump administration. So those are the books that we've written. I host a podcast called Every Little Corner of Cinema. It was running about a year ago, and I'm going to be relaunching it very soon. So by the time this goes up, it might be available. And then I also write articles at a great website called Council of Zoom. And probably the best way to keep track of what I'm doing is I'm on Twitter. CK Vanderk is my handle. So the letters CK and then my name Vanderk, which sounds mostly like you would spell it, except there's two A's at the end, K-A-A-Y. I'm always on there saying stuff and probably deleting it because I probably shouldn't have said it. I retweet all the articles I write and share stuff there. And, you know, I'm working on a film project. Like I said, I don't want to jinx it right now, but it's a really fun idea that I'm working on with some other luminaries in the horror arena. A lot of other writer friends of mine have agreed to work on it with me. So I think it'll be a pretty fun project. So keep all of you apprised of that if you want to follow me on Twitter.
Yeah, absolutely. I will put some links to your social and to your books and things in the show notes for people to check out. And yeah, definitely check out Chris's Twitter. This is sort of perfectly on brand for the podcast. One of your more recent tweets was that, you know, any movie without full frontal male nudity is a waste of your time. That's a sentiment that I wholly full-heartedly endorse.
Yeah, which it, technically Pontypool does not fall into that category, but you know me, I love my film Twitter hot takes.
Absolutely. And we don't get enough full frontal male nudity in movies. It's starting to become a little more common, but I still think it's still seen as very subversive.
Yeah. Well, we'll definitely have to mainstream that.
And yeah. And the funny thing is when you talk about it, you know, everyone talks about, what a trooper the actors are, for going along with it or how brave they are. And I'm like, I don't think I've ever heard anyone say that about a female, that goes topless in a movie or something. Unless it's like something really over the top, like Return of the Living Dead.
They only say a woman is brave if she appears in a movie without makeup on. Then she's brave for some reason. You know what I mean? Like Charlize Theron in Monster or whatever.
Yeah.
But like, yeah, if a dude takes his pants off, it's like, wow, he's a real performer. He doesn't care. Yeah.
Yeah, I think the one I always remember from growing up was the Susan Sarandon. When she played the nun. Dead Man Walking.
Oh right.
I think she did that. Reportedly, she did that with no makeup on.
Well, and I mean, it's all we talk about anymore, right?
So, well, Chris, I really appreciate you jumping on and with very short notice. But this was awesome. This was excellent, and definitely hope more people check out Pontypool.
And hopefully it will pop up because of our conversation. It will hopefully pop up in more places than just Apple TV, and someone will be able to find it somewhere else. Because, like you said, I don't even think I think it's an out of print DVD, and so pretty much that's your only venue right now. But I would encourage if people go and rent it or buy it there, then people will maybe start to notice that there's an uptick of interest in it, and they'll, I'm sure there are so many great boutique labels that could pick this up and do a fantastic transfer of it, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. It's definitely one that that should be revisited for I would think that a place like Arrow, Shout Factory, would be perfect for something like Pontypool.
Well, from your mouth to whoever's ears.
Absolutely.
So, Yeah, and thank you so much for having me on the show, man. I had a blast. I love talking about this movie, but I also like listening to this show, so it was nice to bring two interests together.
Well, thanks. Thanks
for getting your chocolate and my peanut butter.
Thanks, I appreciate that. That's great to hear. Chris, thanks so much for coming on. I had a great time.
Me too. Thanks.
All right. Yeah, you take care.